Good afternoon, everyone. It is February 10th, 2015, and this is a subcommittee on public safety of the Joint Ways and Means Committee. I am going to start today by opening an informational hearing on 2013 sentencing reform, House Bill 3194, avoided cost calculations, and invite up Director Colette Peters from the Department of Corrections.
Good afternoon.
I'm just happy to see you have a big water bottle, just like me.
Madam Chair, mine's a little beat up. I do get some criticism from my colleagues when I walk around the Capitol with my beat up water bottle, but I do just proclaim budget cuts.
Yeah, okay.
And feel that that's representative.
That's good.
Looks like a weapon to me.
I personally thought that was a very nice design.
Thank you. A new Art Deco design.
Exactly.
Thank you, committee members, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, I am Colette Peters, Director of the Department of Corrections. And Madam Chair, as you pointed out, I am here today to talk to you about how we calculated the cost avoidance following the passage of House Bill 3194. Briefly, but first, I want to back up in time. As you recall, when the Governor's Commission on Public Safety began in 2012, so nearly 3 years ago, we were facing a daunting future, a 10-year increase in the prison population of 2,300 inmates at an estimated taxpayer cost over that 10-year period of $600 million. At that time, our 10-year population management plan called for the opening of the medium facility in Madras and beginning the construction of a new prison in Junction City. Upon passage of House Bill 3194, the Department of Corrections and the Criminal Justice Commission really worked collaboratively to create a 10-year state government cost avoidance that amounted to $326 million. And that was really based on the reduced need for beds at the Department of Correction. Then we projected the estimated state government cost avoidance for 13-15 was $19.7 million. And for 15-17, it was $70.3 million. Now, these are the numbers that were projected right after the passage of House Bill 3194, so that's important to remember. Additionally, there were increased costs to community corrections, grant and aid program. We computed those for 13-15 and 15-17 biennium based on the comparison of our original versus the revised community corrections caseload. So this resulted in projected increase in 13-15 of about $1.3 million and an increase in 15-17 of $3.6 million. Now, this net cost avoidance was reported back then and is simply the total state government cost avoidance less the estimated cost to community corrections. So based on those calculations, the original net cost avoidance was reported at $18.4 million for the 13-15 biennium and $66.7 million for the 15-17 biennium. So now you will see here that the numbers change ever so slightly, yet the calculation is still the same. The Criminal Justice Commission issued a report, as required by you in House Bill 3194, to the Justice Reinvestment Grant Review Committee. The report reflected these updates that you see here to the state government cost avoidance and the local government cost. Based on the current information from the Office of Economic Analysis, October 2014 inmate population forecast. Based on the updates, the estimated state government cost avoidance for 13-15 remained at that $19.7 million, and the 2015-17 estimate was reduced from $70.3 million down to $64.5 million. And this really simply was due to the fact that the population did not go down as quickly as we estimated after the passage of 3194.
Oh, I guess I don't have to ask you, Linda, if I can ask a question. Director Peters, can you talk more about what assumptions we made originally and which ones didn't play out? Because I think that's important to understand that some of the things that we thought might happen didn't because of the population.
Certainly. So I'll first just look at the raw numbers, and then I know Director Schmidt is here, and he might be able to fill in more detail for you. Initially, we were projected to be down 750 inmates by July 1, but now we are only estimated to be down 493 inmates. So the cost avoidance is reduced because we're now having to manage the adults in custody. We had some offenders that we projected would not be coming to the Department of Corrections, and though the supermajority of those were those who had committed identity theft, mm-hmm. we projected that we thought that the minimum sentence would be able to drop from 24 months down to 18 months, but on the ground that didn't happen. And the reason it didn't happen is for a good public safety reason. These identity thieves aren't sitting before the judge having committed one case of identity theft. It's multiple, if not hundreds. And so the judges did not see fit to reduce that sentence from 24 months to 18 months.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So the increased community corrections cost now, as we're projecting, is linked to a combination of both community corrections caseloads and baseline funding adjustments. So they remained at the cost of 1.3 for 13-15, but was revised to $6 million for the 15-17 biennium. So let's talk.
Senator.
Just real quick. I assume that what you're getting now is you've got better numbers that we'll look at. The first 13-15 time is just sort of what do we think might happen? And I'm also guessing that the program started in the second half of the biennium, so you only had 8-9 months worth to really look at. Now you're looking at a broader number, and the numbers are probably a lot more stable for you. You know what you're really looking at.
Correct. Madam Chair and Senator Bates, that's absolutely correct. Out of the projections are projections, and we do our best, and the Office of Economic Analysis actually does an incredible job with our population projection numbers. Mm-hmm. Their two-year forecast is incredibly accurate, but you're absolutely right. What we now have is we have actual numbers, and we're able to alter our projections based on what's actually happening with the DAs and the judges in those courtrooms and making a better analysis. You are also correct that I believe these numbers are now, these base numbers are now more solid because of that.
And Madam Chair, just obviously the gain is still huge. It's $58-59 million. So $58 million seems to be a sort of a number you guys use all through your budgets. Is there something
that's
magical about $58 million for you guys?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, it's our magic number.
Okay.
It is, but it's magic based on these calculations.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
So now let's actually look at the population numbers that are driving this conversation. Prior to House Bill 3194, and also in accordance with the April 2013 prison population forecast, the prison population was estimated to grow by 1,795 inmates over a 10-year period, beginning July 1. 2013. Now, fast forward, using the most recent forecast from October 2014, which assumes the full implementation of 3194, the inmate population is expected to grow now by only 415 inmates over the same period. So a substantial impact based on the passage of 3194. The net population impact based on the most current forecast is a reduction of 1,402 inmates in prison over the 10-year period beginning July 1, 2013. So that's substantial change. Now I'll get down into a little more detail. Over the next three slides, I'm actually going to briefly outline how we calculated the cost avoidance. In order to calculate what we're referring to as the state government cost avoidance, we simply looked at the projected cost to run the system pre-3194 and the projected cost now based on the actuals and the Office of Economic Analysis projections, and then we simply present the difference between those two numbers. Based on using the updated forecast, the revised estimated 10-year cost avoidance of state government is $447.8 million that you would have had to have spent on the Department of Corrections absent the passage of 3194. So what exactly are we avoiding? I would like to call your attention to the 1517 line and look at the pre-3194 column. Here, there is a cost avoidance of $72.2 million. This is substantially more than the 1315, and that's primarily driven by the need to open the Deer Ridge facility that sits empty in Madras, as well as the minimum facility at the Oregon State Penitentiary for Women due to the now population growth projected at that time. So those are two substantial items that we would have had to pay for absent the passage of 3194. Additionally, even more cost avoidance in the 1790 biennium, totaling $146.3 million. Now, this number is because we previously anticipated the issuance of $141.9 million in bonds in the 1719 biennium for the construction of the Junction City Minimum Facility. Again, the community corrections costs. The increased cost to community corrections now is calculated by simply subtracting the current estimated community corrections grants and aid caseload cost from the estimated community corrections grants and aid caseload cost prior to the passage of 3194. The increased cost in 1315 is an estimated $1.3 million, which offsets that overall cost avoidance. And the increased cost in the 1517 biennium is an estimated $6 million, again, offsetting our overall cost avoidance. If you look at this slide, you can actually see the offset here. This brings us to conclusion, which is $18.4 million in net cost avoidance for the current biennium, and 58, that magic number, Senator, $58.5 million in the 1517 biennium. So now I will conclude with this slide, which many of you have not seen yet, and I really appreciate that my team put this together, because I think this really highlights for you where we are today and where we would have been had 3194 not passed. If you look at the solid red line, this is the point at which we will need the Junction City facility. So once I hit that number for my projections for the inmate population, that's when we would have to have the need for that facility. The dashed red line is the point at which we will need to open Deer Ridge Minimum. As you can see with the turquoise line, the full impacts of 3194 is what that line represents. The estimated prison population will not trigger the need to construct the Junction City Prison anywhere in the 10-year period. And as I mentioned earlier, the activation of the Deer Ridge Medium Facility will not become necessary now until the 1921 biennium. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Questions. I know there was a lot in that, and some of us had the background in it, but not all of us. So I thought it was really important for Director Peters to come and walk us through the numbers, and so we can understand why we did what we did last session and the assumptions we made, especially around identity theft, that didn't play out, because that was actually a big assumption that that did not come true.
That's right.
So being able to be flexible around those kinds of things and understand what is happening out there on the ground, I think is very important. You look like you have a question, Senator. No,
I'm just thinking
that the last session when we're doing our budget work, and you know, I was looking at a $22 billion budget, I had to cut money out of it, and over in corrections, which I wasn't directly involved with, I knew they were doing this package, and I didn't realize what a groundbreaking package it was, and I voted for it, but I didn't realize the great work you guys did. I mean, you those of who were here last session should be congratulated for doing a really great job. I may have to ask you more to help me with my other budgets. If we get everything down to $58 million, we're in great shape.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I appreciate those comments very much. The commission worked very hard. As a sitting commissioner, I can tell you it was a hard 2 years of work. So the work that you did on your respective floors was greatly appreciated. I had the privilege of attending a national conference where all of the states who engaged in justice reinvestment came together to talk about what worked and what did not work. And I will tell you, in every room, they were, and with every conversation, they were applauding the efforts in Oregon. So you should be proud. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I just...
Senator Winters.
Just a comment on Senator Bates. You know, it was a two-year work effort and not just one. And also, those of us who've been involved in 3194 are continuing to work on $31.94, some components and efforts. So, I mean, I think the investment, because, you know, that we saw and what happened, I think we kind of, all of us, I speak for the majority, we became very invested in it.
We did.
And not just those who are on the budget, but those who are on policy, because, you know, Representative Barker and Krieger and others, we became very invested in making certain that this was going to work, as well as our partners that, like I commented yesterday to DA Underhill, it became, you know, a work that whether you were with community corrections or the chief of police and the sheriffs and others, that we wanted to put this package and make it work. And I think we're still working on it. I mean, it's, there's still some components and pieces that we think. So if you want to do it on your side, on your budget, it's a 2-year effort. Plus.
We could do it in 2 years. But you should be congratulated. It must have been a huge effort. And those of us who were intimately involved just voted as part of the big budget, didn't realize what exactly had happened here. You should be all congratulated for doing this. It's pretty amazing.
You. Having four co-chairs is an undertaking, a feat all of itself.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Peters, on slide 6, the community corrections cost increase. Are we comfortable in that $6 million? My county, because they've heard, is a $20 or $30 million difference in the co-chairs, and even more than that at $58.6 million, if you take the exact number, but difference between the co-chairs and the governor's budget. So they're actually out relooking at how much they spent for this. So do you expect that number to be good, or is there going to be some corrections to that number? And also, the community correction facilities or upgrades, that's going to be in the future. Won't that need to be some additional money spent for more use of those facilities or for the expansion too?
Co-chairs, Representative Wisnant, to your first question, we are confident in those numbers today. Of course, they can change as caseload growth change, as things change, as the counties look closer at what they have spent and what their needs are, that certainly could change. But as of today, we are comfortable with that number. And I believe OACCD is as well. Yeah, today. Thank you. To your second question, can you remind me, Representative Wisnant, which facilities are you referring to?
Well, all their facilities and their staff too. That they're putting, if they're putting more people in community corrections, then there's going to be more wear and tear on those facilities. So that may need upgrading, maintenance, additional maintenance, or things like that.
Co-chairs, Representative Wisnant, those monies aren't included in this part of the conversation. And I will say that while we are very proud of these efforts, I will be very clear, as I have been in the past, that still the Justice Reinvestment Initiative dollars are still no silver bullet for community corrections. The reductions that they've had to make during the Great Recession over the last 8 to 10 years have been substantial. Mm-hmm. And this really is, we're asking a lot of the counties, right? We're asking them to be very progressive with these dollars, when in reality they're still stopping the bleeding, if you will. And so I know that that will be the case not only for the program and their caseloads, but also the facilities in which they're in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else? All right. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you, co-chairs. Thank you, members.
That I will close an informational hearing and open a public hearing on House Bill 5032, the Oregon Military Department.
It's a minute.
Ms. Gilbert. Thank you. Members, before you, this is the military department is coming in for the next 3 days. And on OLIS, you have the LFO overview of their budget. You have the agency's presentation plus an appendix. The DAS presentation is there. And the entire governor's budget is there, all 789 pages of it. Also on OLIS today is a response to a question that came up yesterday with respect to CJC, KPM number 2, something about what didn't work, and that response is posted for your edification. Finally, there are hard copies of the governor's budget behind me and presentation materials if you'd like to see it in paper. And as you see, you just received a handout. This handout will be posted to OLIS after the meeting. And with that, my housekeeping is finished.
Major General.
Okay. Madam Co-Chair, Co-Chair Shields, Senator Bates, Senator Winters, Representative Wisnab, Representative Krieger, Representative Barker, Representative Gorsuch. For the record, I'm Dan Hokanson, the Adjutant General for Oregon, and I'm accompanied today by part of my staff, but particularly Chief Master Sergeant Andy Gauntz. He's a senior enlisted leader of the Oregon Air National Guard, and Sean McCormick from the Interagency Command. I want to thank you for the opportunity to provide your committee an overview of the Oregon Military Department, and we have provided copies of two of our three documents that compose our strategic planning system, a strategic letter, and what's called the strategic direction of the Oregon Military Department, as well as a two-page synopsis of our Cascadia playbook, and also what we call the disaster horse blanket, which is a bunch of lines, and it kind of talks about what we would do. If you have questions at any time during my presentation, please let me know. Barring questions, my brief's about 30 minutes, and we have a 13-minute video at the very end. Okay. Next slide, please. I'd like to begin by briefly highlighting two outstanding members of your Oregon Military Department. On the left, on the far right side, next to the ISAF four-star, is Lieutenant Colonel Mike Burkhart. Mike graduated from Western Oregon State College and entered the active Army and then came into the Oregon National Guard after he left active duty. Mike lives in Clatskanie, and he's the energy manager at the Georgia Pacific's Wana Mill and assists with coaching basketball, baseball, and football in Clatskanie. In November, on 1 week's notice, Mike stepped forward to deploy to Afghanistan and backfill the commander of our 2nd Battalion, 162nd Infantry, who had to be medevaced from theater due to medical reasons. Literally 3 weeks from my first call to Mike, he was in Afghanistan leading 400 Oregon soldiers and has done an exceptional job every day since. On the right is Air National Guard Staff Sergeant Derek Yeager. Similar to Mike, this Air Force Special Operations Command needed an immediate short notice replacement of an active duty airman with very specific training and qualifications. As a member of the 125th Special Tactics Squadron, since 2009, Derek was officially notified and was in theater within 3 weeks. During his deployment, Derek will lead a four-person team that's conducting airfield surveys throughout the entire Middle East. This deployment will be his second as a member of the 125th, but his sixth deployment since September 11th. Next slide. During my presentation, I'll review our vision, mission, and priorities, our new organizational structure, our dual missions, how we support our state and nation, our current operational deployments, where we are located around the state, highlight our strength and assets, review the Office of Emergency Management, and our Youth Challenge Program. And at the end, we have what's called a year-in-review video. I welcome your questions, and any additional detail will be covered either at the end of my presentation or in subsequent meetings by Mr. Dave Stuckey. Next slide, please. The strategic director of our organization has been under development since I assumed duties over a year ago and implemented the Oregon Military Department strategic planning system. Our strategic planning system is composed of three documents. You have two of them there with you. The first is a one-page strategic letter that really lays out our vision, mission, and priorities. The second is a 14-page document, because I like to keep these as small as possible, and it really takes a look at our priorities and identifies the key efforts that we need to make those happen. The third document is in its final draft right now, and it'll be published later this spring, and it's our strategic plan, but really looks at our outlook over the next 5 years. And, of course, the vision and mission that you see here, and if I get the next slide, please, as well, and the priorities were all developed as part of that process. And the second document you have, the strategic direction, actually tells you all about the sub-elements of this, and I can answer questions on any of those at any time. Okay. Next slide, please. When I assumed duties as the Adjutant General, I did a complete review of the organization, and I apologize. This is a very busy slide, and there's just a couple of things I wanted to highlight with it. What we did is I put all the Army and the Air Forces under a single commander so that they can focus on their specific service mission, not only within the state, but also their federal mission. To the far left, I took all the admin functions that support the entire organization and put them together. The reason I've done this is in light of the Budget Control Act and sequestration, we are anticipating significant full-time personnel cuts. So by combining those elements for both the Army and the Air Force, we think that we can save personnel costs over time, and if we lose those personnel, we can still maintain the adequate support to the organization. Probably the most important, though, is the second column from the left, the ATAG for operations. And what we did is, because we have not only a federal mission but the state mission, what I wanted to do is have a headquarters that's dedicated solely to responding to anything that may occur within the state of Oregon. And so on a drill weekend, when this organization meets, they train for a Cascadia, for forest fires, for floods, so that if any event occurs, we already have a headquarters and staff identified. One point I'll show you there is you'll see in parentheses it has DSC. And if you're not familiar with this, this is a concept that was developed about 4.5 years ago when I was at Northern Command. It's called a dual status commander. And what we found is in large-scale operations, such as in Katrina and Hurricane Sandy, that we have an influx of active duty forces into a state which may not be familiar with them. Oregon's one of the few states, I believe six, that have no active duty service bases. So what we worked with the Pentagon is saying that our officers that are raised and trained in Oregon know just about everything about the state, they know a lot of the key leaders, and they know the disasters we regularly face. And so if someone is certified as a dual status commander, in this case it's Brigadier General Jeff Silver, who lives in Klamath Falls, any active duty forces that enter the state of Oregon will fall under his command, and so that we'll have an Oregon National Guard officer in charge of any active duty forces that enter the state, which is a great program. And then to the far right, the last one I'd like to highlight is our interagency command that's led by Dave Stuckey. And those are primarily the civilian or state-specific functions, such as the Office of Emergency Management, our Youth Challenge Program, and our Installations Branch. Next slide, please. Okay. A highlight here is to talk about the fact that we're a dual-use force. We're very fortunate because we have a lot of great assets that are provided by the federal government that most states could never afford themselves. When I took over the helicopter rescue squadron here in Salem in 2002, what we realized is we had 15 of the most state-of-the-art rescue helicopters in the country sitting on our runway. And so through a program that took us about a year and a half, we met with all the state sheriff's associations and integrated our aircraft and our crews into their search and rescue programs. And this is just one of the many examples. And what we found was, the first thing was we could actually make a difference in our communities. And the first big event we did was the disaster on Mount Hood when the Air Force Reserve helicopter crashed during a rescue. And we actually rescued all four personnel as well as the Air Force crew, provided support to them as well. But what we found is not only did they make a difference in their communities, but when they deployed into Afghanistan and Iraq, they were so well trained because they were used to operating in difficult conditions on no notice in the state of Oregon that they were actually named the best medevac unit in the entire United States Army, active guard and reserve. And so we learned a lot, and we gained a lot from that. And there's just one of the pictures here that show the fact we do our federal and our state mission. Next slide, please. Specific to the Army National Guard, right now we have just over 1,000 soldiers in the Middle East. Almost one-tenth of the forces in Afghanistan are members of the Oregon National Guard as we speak. So that's our federal mission. On the bottom side, you'll see with the Army as well, we have fight forest fires as we did over the last two summers. And hopefully we'll get some more snowpack so we won't be as busy this summer.
Senator?
General, why are you one-tenth? We're 1% of the national population. We're 10% of people in Afghanistan.
Co-Chair Williamson, Senator Bates, yes, sir. Due to the rotational schedule, the 41st Brigade Combat Team, this is actually the brigade's third deployment. We have a tendency to deploy a little bit more than some states, but I'd say, sir, that's a reflection of the capabilities of the folks that we have. We originally had the entire or a large portion of the brigade, but as they drew down the forces, we actually just got to about 1,000 right now. But yes, sir, it's very significant.
Ella?
Yes.
What's that been like for the morale of the troops?
Co-Chair Williamson, Senator Bates. Sir, surprisingly, a lot of our soldiers really enjoy these deployments. Now, I will tell you there's impact on the families and themselves, and we have incredible support within the state of Oregon, not just our communities, but our employers. And a lot of times we have the visibility or the availability to identify soldiers that do want to go in place of those that don't. Fortunately, when you look at the 41st Brigade, about 3,500 soldiers, only 1,000, we were in a pretty good spot to select those that did want to continue.
I'm just pointing out that going overseas for a year away from your family on a repetitive basis is pretty tough to do.
Yeah.
But I appreciate you trying to manage that.
Yes, sir.
Senator Winters.
Talk to us a little about the challenge of returning services that are needed for the individuals as they and families as they return home. Not only the medical and some of those, but employment issues, and because we're now seeing also where some of the our returnees are ending up with us having to do veterans courts and whatever. Speak to us a little about that particular issue and, you know, what's in place to try to assist the returning guardsmen or guardswoman.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Winters, as a brief history, the first deployment I had as a lieutenant into Just Cause in Panama, when I came home, we landed at night, we got off the plane, and they said, did everybody turn in your weapons? They said, we'll see you work on Monday. And that was our welcome home. Over the last 13 years, we've learned a lot about that, and we continue to improve our processes. Specifically to the most recent deployment, having deployed twice with the 41st Brigade, our senior enlisted advisor, Command Sergeant Major Lake, and I, we have meetings for our families while they're deployed, and he and I attend virtually every single one to meet with the family members, ask their questions, and try and anticipate either concerns they have or at least get them to resources. We have a yellow ribbon program, and we have currently 48 full-time personnel for our transition assistance for all of our service members. We do every other week, we do a call with the unit downrange to identify those soldiers or airmen that do not have employment when they get back. And so we're working with our employer support of the Guard and Reserve to help identify those individuals and connect them with either interviews that they can do downrange or connect them with companies in their local area if that's where they'd like to stay as soon as they get back. We're also working with educational institutions because our soldiers are earning Montgomery GI Bill, well, not Montgomery GI Bill, the new GI Bill program. So we want to make sure that they leverage that as well if they want to come back and go to school. Not only our regular institutions, but also trade schools as well. When it comes to the families, we try to meet with them on a regular basis, and we have our full-time support personnel call them to see if they have any issues so we can try and identify them as well. Specific to the units that are currently deployed, they did their pre-deployment training in Fort Bliss, Texas, and Fort Hood, Texas. So when their deployment's over, they will return there. While they're there, they'll go through comprehensive medical examinations and evaluations to make sure any injuries that they sustained are cleared and identified. And having learned from previous events, I have required the chain of command to make sure that an 06 or a colonel, one of our higher ranking officers, is always there. So if there's an issue, we can resolve it at the lowest level before the soldiers get home. In addition, we're working with Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs for the long-term solution for our soldiers and their families once they return. Ma'am, I would tell you, we can never do enough for them. And we're trying to do everything we can. And we learn from other states as well to try and use the best systems identified to provide them the best care we can. Our priority is we would not be an organization without people. And we want them to come back and be productive members of their community. And frankly, we want them to stay in uniform because the experience they gain is going to help them develop the next generations of leaders.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am. Next slide, please. And this is specific to our Air National Guard. And I would ask you to look very closely in the upper right-hand picture. That's a Russian strategic bomber. And that's the second flight that we've had off the Oregon coast in the last 3 years. Mm-hmm. That occurred this summer. And you can see that photo was taken from the inside of one of our jets. 24/7, we have an air control alert squadron up in Portland Air National Guard Base. At the end of my brief, I'll actually show you the differences in how we really cover the whole Pacific Northwest of the United States. They are there 24/7. They are in the air in less than 10 to 15 minutes, and they will go anywhere on the West Coast to protect our country and our territorial sovereignty. In addition to that, they are also a deployable unit. And based on the events that are taking place in Ukraine right now and the proposed withdrawal of our F-15 squadron out of Lake and Heath, England, more than likely our units will start deploying into Europe on a regular basis to provide additional presence in light of what's taking place in Europe right now. In addition, in case you're not aware of this, we train all F-15 fighter pilots in the United States Air Force in Klamath Falls. That's active duty, reserve, and National Guard. In fact, 40% of the F-15s in the United States Air Force in the United States are in Oregon, which is a pretty significant event. On the lower left picture, this is what we called our CBRN, which is chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, and explosive, and it's an enhanced response force package. This is a group of just over 200 soldiers and airmen that train to respond to building collapses, for any contamination, and help extract folks and provide immediate medical care in support of our civilian agencies. They also have a pretty extensive communications capability should we lose telephone and internet services. Okay. Next slide, please. Sir, back to your questions on our deployment. If you look over, we went back basically to 2002 after 9/11. We've had almost 5,000 activations in support of the state since that time. But if you look at those deployed on federal active duty, over 20,000. As an example, I would show you 2009. That's when the 41st Brigade deployed. But we were there well into 2010, and those numbers are not reflected there. But that shows the level. And to the right, it's actually 1,016 as of this morning. But that's how many Oregonians we currently have deployed in the Middle East. And this is not just Afghanistan. This is Kuwait. And I would tell you as well, some of our folks in Kuwait are no longer in Kuwait, but they've moved north to assist with operations there as well. Okay. Next slide, please. This is something that I like to show our folks. I get a copy of this every single morning. This one's actually dated from when we submitted the slides, but it does show where our folks are deployed around the world. If you get the large block in Afghanistan, Command Sergeant Major Lake and I were able to visit them in Afghanistan in November. If you look into Kuwait, next week I'll actually be in Kuwait visiting our soldiers that are there. Two other things I'd like to highlight that you may not be aware of. If you look at Vietnam and Bangladesh, Oregon has state partnerships with both of these countries. And so we actually have an Oregon National Guard officer serving full-time in the embassy in Vietnam and in Bangladesh. And we do regular trips to those countries. And what we do is we help them with humanitarian assistance and disaster response and search and rescue. Probably one of our premier programs is when we look at Vietnam. Because of the communist government still in control there, they are very sensitive to military engagements. However, they are very thankful that we have a National Guard relationship, and we work with them on building collapses, and you'll see some of this in the video, as well as search and rescue capabilities. And it's starting a means of communication for our government that hopefully will progress to more in the future. And I know that two of you have visited there previously. Next slide, please. This is just a map of where we're located throughout the state. The key here is the red stars. Those are our training facilities. We have two air bases, but actually three Air National Guard locations and 36 armories across the state. The thing that's significant about this, and one of the beauties of the National Guard, is really our connection to the fabric of America. When you look at our active component forces, they have a tendency to move to much larger bases in concentrated areas, really away from the public. One of the advantages of the National Guard is when we deploy, we bring the nation to war. And I would tell you the level of support that we have in our state, I would say, is unprecedented across the country. When I talk about our relationship with our communities and the support we get, a lot of states are very jealous of that. So we're very thankful for what we get here in Oregon. Next slide, please. Specific to the Army, and once again, I apologize for the for all the data here. But what I'm trying to highlight here is some of our main formations. And when we talk about our capabilities, it's not just that we have tanks and helicopters. What we also have is a chain of command and a staff that actually can react to incidents, plan, and help mitigate and support any local agency that's in the lead. So we're there to help out any way that we can. One here, if I look at the lower left, the 102nd Civil Support Team. This is a 22-person team that is on a 90-minute recall 24/7. They provide a mobile lab that is extremely expensive, and virtually no states can really afford it. But because it's federally funded, it does not cost the state anything. But anytime there's a substance or a white powder, these folks respond in support of local hazmat teams and can determine what it is in a very rapid manner, saving time and manpower, and also providing that resource to the local law enforcement agencies so they can make decisions based on the information we can provide. The concern I would highlight here is, in light of the Budget Control Act and sequestration, we spend a lot of time with our federal partners in working our federal planning. If there is no relief from sequestration in the Budget Control Act, we stand to lose 10%, or about 640 members of the Oregon Army National Guard. That's something I'm involved with at the highest levels, and we're doing everything we can. National Defense Authorization Act directed a commission on the study, the future of the Army, and I'm a significant part of the National Guard response to that commission. So we'll do everything that we can to retain these capabilities in our state. Next slide, please. I'm an aviator. I like pictures, so I want to show you pictures of all the stuff that we have. A couple of things to highlight here is our engineer equipment, our bulldozer and excavators. We're very critical to make sure we maintain those and keep those units in the state because of their potential use that we may need under a Cascadia-type event or earthquake because of their capabilities. Also, our helicopters. In Pendleton, Oregon, we currently have 7 Chinook, which are heavy-duty helicopters. We were just recently notified that that unit will likely deploy in the next year. But what we're able to leverage is then to get the latest generation of those helicopters. We have currently a D model, but for lack of better terms, the new version is more powerful. It's an all-glass cockpit and provides much great increased capabilities. So we're looking forward to getting those here. One thing that we're working at the national level, though, as well, while they are deployed, we're trying to get additional helicopters to stay in the rear so that we can still provide forest fire fighting support to the state of Oregon, because the unit they deploy with is also out of Washington. So across the region, we're going to see a loss in military helicopters. So we're working at the federal level to make sure we don't lose that capability within Oregon. And then, of course, our Black Hawk helicopters, they are the state-of-the-art, probably one of the best helicopters in the world right now. And our folks, as you saw recently, as a week ago, they're involved with rescues up on Mount Hood and throughout Oregon almost on a weekly basis. Next slide, please. Okay, on the Air National Guard side, obviously we have our fighter squadron in Portland. If you're not aware of it, the fighter squadron in Portland is literally the best fighter squadron in the United States Air Force. They set the standard every time the evaluators come here. When you look at the intercepts that they've done off the Oregon coast, every time that they go to operational exercises, they get rated really literally the highest of anybody through. We've got outstanding folks there, and Colonel Rick Wadan retired this past weekend, and Colonel Paul Fitzgerald took over, and they're under fantastic leadership. When we look at Portland, for the cost there, it's only a 20% share. The federal government pays 80%. And it's a little bit better when we go down to Kingsley Field, where we train all F-15 fighter pilots, where it's the federal government pays 85% of the share and the state 15%. One thing about the Kingsley Field in Klamath Falls, they're also the third largest employer in Klamath County. So it's a significant input to the community. In addition, recently we were able to get a 68-person full-time Air Force unit assigned there as well. So we're actually increasing the number of personnel there on the full-time side to increase economic influx into the area. On the State Combat Operations Group, I just like to highlight 2 units there. The 125th Special Tactics Squadron, this is the Air Force equivalent to Special Operations. That unit earned 23 Bronze Stars and a Silver Star over the past few years. Absolutely incredible capability. We have two of their folks downrange now, and they commonly rotate in and out into the most difficult environments. Most of those folks are on U.S. Army Special Forces teams or in direct support of the Navy SEALs, and they provide air cover, and they train and deploy with them everywhere they go. The second one is the 116th Air Control Squadron, which is based out of Warrenton. In May of this year, 90 of those personnel will deploy overseas in support of operations in the Middle East. The good news story on the Air National Guard side is a presidential budget for 16 just came out, and it reaffirmed that we will not receive any aircraft cuts. We had been working extremely hard this year because they were looking at cutting the number of aircraft in Portland from 21 to 18 and from Kingsley Field from 32 down to 24. Through aggressive work at the national level, we were able to maintain all those aircraft. And also, they had planned to cut 98 full-time personnel out of Kingsley Field. We were able to bring in the leadership. Thank goodness, the four-star general in charge of this aspect of the Air Force, his father was the wing commander in Kingsley Field, and he went to high school there. So we brought him back home, showed him the importance of that, and with his support and the National Guard Bureau, we were able to retain those 98 full-time positions and 22 up at Portland. Next slide, please. And let's just highlight the number of aircraft we have at each location. One thing that we did get as well in the presidential budget is the F-15 is an aircraft that goes back to the 1970s. The newest fighter jet is the F-35. The F-35 will come and go, and the F-15 will still be in service based on the lifespan of that airframe. And so we're doing everything we can to maintain our capabilities here in Oregon. On the other hand, we're also looking 10 to 20 years out. What are the things that we need to do at Kingsley Field over the next 5 to 10 years so that 20 years from now, when they eventually do retire the F-15, we'll be in a position to then start training the next generation of fighter aircraft there. Next slide, please. The next two slides, I just wanted to show you the air control alert mission across the United States. We have 12 units in 15 locations, and you'll see in the upper left, Portland. And if you go to the next slide, this is the reason why it is so important. There's really, if you look at the other units, that's how far they away, and that's how long it would take them to get to Portland or Seattle, whereas Portland, it's just a matter of minutes. In this case, 12 minutes from Portland to Seattle.
On the previous slide, what happens to the Midwest? They seem to be lacking.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. Yes, they look at our border with Canada, and we have what's called NORAD, North American Air Defense Command, where we work with Canada. And in the next slide, you'll see Cold Lake. And in Colorado Springs, we actually work very closely with the Canadians to make sure that there are no gaps in coverage. But we have not forgotten the Midwest.
This is fighter alert, not missiles.
Okay.
Just checking. Thank you.
Yes. Okay. Next slide, please.
Missiles.
The last two slides I have are related to the Office of Oregon Emergency Management and the Youth Challenge Program. Just prior to assuming the duties as the Adjutant General, I met with the governor, and I try and look at things of what keeps me up at night. And the thing that keeps me up at night is a Cascadia event. Short of nuclear war, that's probably the greatest disaster that we face in Oregon. In a typical military fashion, what we try and do is plan for the absolute worst incident, knowing that anything short of that we'll be able to handle. And so when we looked at the worst night in Oregon, we really looked at a Cascadia-type event. And you'll see in the picture here in the upper left, that's the governor signing in the fact that we did implement the Cascadia playbook. And as a brief story, about 4 years ago, I was at the North American Air Defense Headquarters, and we were doing a trial exercise with another general officer, and it was basically an intercept of an aircraft approaching the U.S. airspace. And NORAD has been around since 1958, and so in this exercise, they took out the checklist. Everyone in the room followed the checklist, as they did at 1st Air Force in Florida, as well as in Washington, D.C. And this way, as the aircraft approached, everyone knew exactly what we were doing and what the next step was. The gentleman that was there with me looked at me and said, wow, what if we could do this for natural disasters? What if we could develop a checklist so that every time they occurred, we didn't reinvent the wheel, but we had a basis on what we learned from the past to refer to? The officer that I was there was General Frank Grass, who is now the commander, four-star, and a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And so when he went to lead the National Guard forces, I actually went with him as a strategic planner. And we developed a national-level plan, and I promised him when I was told I was going to get to come back to Oregon that we would do the first one in the state of Oregon, and this is the result. Now, the great work here, really, and you've got a two-page summary there, was done by Dave Stuckey while he was the head of the Office of Emergency Management and his deputy, Lori Holian. Mm-hmm. And I can show you my version. It's a little bit worn. I take it everywhere I go. The governor has a copy, as does the Secretary of State and the Treasurer and most of the agencies that are referred to in this. The intent is this is probably about a 50 to 60% product, but we wanted to get something out because we don't control the timeline when this might occur. It may take us 4 to 6 years to get a 90% effort, but we wanted to start somewhere. And on the inside cover, it says, if you've got recommendations on how to improve this, it gives an email address. Each of these are dated, and we'll come out with a new version on the 1st of July every year, unless we can get one out quicker. And then we actually use this. And when I talk about the headquarters we established to practice disasters within the state of Oregon, we use this and we jot down notes. And we also identify agencies within the state that we would rely upon to respond as quickly as possible. Our number one goal is to take care of our citizens in our local communities, in our state and nation. And this is probably one of the biggest things we could do. And so we're putting a lot of effort into this to make sure that heaven forbid if it occurs, we're ready for it. Next slide, please. The final point here I'd like to show is our Youth Challenge Program, and I know Senator Winters is very familiar with this. And I cannot tell you enough, if you have not been there, I would highly encourage you to go. If not, to at least visit the course, but to attend one of their graduations. It is something you will never forget to see how children that may have lost their way are brought back into the fold, given an opportunity to gain additional high school credits to either go back to their high school or to graduate or to go on to college. It's a six-month in-resident program just outside of Redmond. We run two classes a year. The current capacity is 156 students per class. And with the proposal to get $4.97 million added to that, it'll allow us to seismically retrofit it, make improvements, but also increase the class size by 80, which would include additional 24 spaces for females. And a person I'd like to highlight here is Mr. Dan Radabaugh. Dan, if you could. Dan's run the program for years. It has literally won every award. And I cannot tell you enough about the great job that he does. And if at any time you are available to come out there, we'd love to show it to you. So, great program.
Madam Chair, it's a program that I've have supported over the years, and actually last session when some of us toured, and I actually put in my request a couple of years ago that we needed to expand the capacity at Teen Challenge so that we can have more young ladies in the program. And so I'm pleased to see that you did do a POP and that you took the comment seriously. It is one of the programs that if you look at the success rate, it's very successful, and I think that we've enjoyed being one of the leaders in the nation, if I can recall some of the stats correctly. And you know, these are young people who, as you said, have, you know, kind of lost their way, and in some instance would not be in the seat in the classroom in their communities, and to see them not only you know, succeed, but then go back and graduate with their class. So there's a lot of win-wins with Teen Challenge, and yes, and I'm a huge supporter.
Senator Bates.
Anecdotally, I've had a lot of patients go through this program. We turned some troubled youth around, because I think everybody ought to go through boot camp, but that's just me. Okay. what I would like to know is, do you have a waiting list, and how long is it, and what's the cost per student going through that six-month program?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Bates, the level of detail, I think Dan would be the best one to answer that, and he could answer it at this time, sir, or we can get it to you immediately afterwards.
Later is fine.
Okay.
I think when you do your detailed budget, that would be an opportune time to actually plot into waiting lists and where the students are coming from in the state, because they are coming from all over the state, not just the Portland metro area. So that kind of information would be helpful for members of the committee.
Can I offer one more question?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in that information you give us, could you tell us about your relation with OYA, Oregon Youth Authority? I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Okay, next slide, please. Madam Co-Chair, at this time we have a 13-minute video, and if you have any questions, there's a couple of things that I haven't touched on yet that you'll see in the video, and I'll try and cover those at the end.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
Five soldiers from 1st Battalion 186. The National Guard's federal mission continued to support efforts in the global war on terrorism this year. More than 1,000 soldiers and airmen left for overseas deployments, while others returned home in 2014. In March, the Army Guard's 2641 Aviation Battalion returned home from Kosovo after 9 months providing aeromedical evacuations and patient transportation in support of Operation Joint Guardian. The task force flew 600 total flight hours, which translated into 350 missions, 23 of which were medical evacuations. That same month, 28 Air Guard members from the 142nd Fighter Wing Civil Engineer Squadron deployed to Bagram, Afghanistan, where they provided support and maintenance services to facilities, airfields, and base infrastructure. The unit was also advised that they may be assisting with clearing and dismantling facilities in preparation for the ongoing drawdown in Afghanistan. Another engineer unit also deployed to Kuwait this year. Approximately 180 soldiers from the Oregon Army National Guard's 234 Engineer Company departed in June. These highly trained and multi-skilled soldiers have been focusing their efforts on plumbing, electrical, and carpentry that has improved the infrastructure in that area. The soldiers are expected back in March of 2015. Large elements of the Army Guard's 41st Infantry Brigade Combat Team also deployed to Afghanistan in June. Approximately 400 soldiers from 2nd Battalion 162nd Infantry, based in Springfield, approximately 190 soldiers from 1st Squadron 82nd Cavalry, based in Bend, and approximately 275 soldiers from 1st Battalion 186th Infantry, based in Ashland, deployed in support of Operation Enduring Freedom to provide security and support for bases in and around Kabul. These units spent several weeks of intense and all-encompassing pre-deployment training at the Orchard Combat Training Center in Idaho. Soldiers qualified on all types of weapons.
Yeah, good way to end it.
Oregon Guard's involvement overseas also extends into Southeast Asia. A delegation from Vietnam visited Oregon in August to attend briefings on disaster response and observe Oregon's SURF-P evaluation exercise. The delegation experienced firsthand how Oregon deals with building collapses, utilizing the new rubble pile training facility at Camp Rylea this past year. On the heels of the delegation visit, 9 Oregon Army Guardsmen from the 224 Engineer Company attended a disaster response training exercise in Vietnam. The nations continued to exchange information on search and rescue scenarios, including repelling, rescue hoist operations, and casualty extraction operations. Saving life and limb is the primary objective of Oregon's aviation assets. The units from the 2641 Aviation Battalion conducted a number of real-life search and rescue operations this year. The pilots and crews responded to more than 30 search and rescue operations, assisting civil authorities with locating lost and stranded citizens. Oregon Guard helicopters also served Oregon citizens during wildfire season. Oregon Guard helicopters dropped more than 802,000 gallons of water over wildfires to suppress more than 45,000 acres of burning land in Jefferson and Jackson counties. Oregon soldiers and airmen continually rise to challenges that many may never face either in or out of uniform. It takes willpower, focus, and skill to overcome these obstacles. This past spring, Oregon Air National Guard Tech Sergeant Douglas Matthews of the 125th Special Tactics Squadron was awarded the rarely received Silver Star for engaging and repelling the enemy from multiple firing points after his vehicle struck an IED. Three more airmen of the 125th STS, Staff Sergeant Matthew Matlock, Staff Sergeant Christopher Jones, and Tech Sergeant George Thompson were awarded Bronze Stars for their valiant bravery under fire.
You couldn't be prouder of these folks for what they do, but you couldn't be prouder of the community, their friends, and their families for the support that they give them for the things that they do that enables our nation to promote freedom and democracy all over the planet.
Matthews was chosen as the Air National Guard Outstanding Non-Commissioned Officer of the Year and one of the Air Force Outstanding Airmen of the Year. Oregon also took home a national title in the Army National Guard Best Warrior Competition when Sergeant First Class Scott Stimson of the Recruiting and Retention Battalion earned Non-Commissioned Officer of the Year at Camp Robinson in Arkansas. Meanwhile, Oregon soldiers began competing at the state level to prepare for the next year's title. This three-day event pushes soldiers to the limits by testing their physical and mental endurance and evaluating their soldiering skills. The final test requires problem-solving and team-building abilities. This year, the culminating event required soldiers to carry Zodiac boats to a lake and then move to their final objective. After the training lanes are completed, the top competitors are selected to represent the state in the regional competition. Now, Sergeant First Class Benedict of Joint Force Headquarters took first place as Oregon's NCO of the Year, and Private First Class J.I. Stone of the 2 to the 218th Field Artillery Headquarters Battery took the title of Soldier of the Year. The Oregon National Guard completed a number of infrastructure projects this year. The most notable was the opening of the new Fort Dallas Readiness Center. U.S. Senators Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley were on hand for the ribbon-cutting ceremony.
So it is just a moment when the heart soars on behalf of all the folks who made this happen, all the folks who are going to be able to use this facility in the many decades ahead.
The new facility will be home to Alpha Company 3rd Battalion, 116th Cavalry Regiment. This new 62,000 square foot net zero compliant state-of-the-art facility will also be utilized by the Columbia Gorge community. Ensuring the completion of this facility was a collaborative effort between the college, the Oregon National Guard, and local state and federal officials, resulting in a facility that will be a shining example for the community for decades to come. The Milton Freewater Armory was upgraded and rededicated this year in April. The armory was first built in 1954 and served as a civil defense headquarters and Red Cross kitchen during the 1964 and 65 floods. The $4 million remodel began in 2012 to replace and upgrade the building's electrical, plumbing, and seismic requirements. The building also meets state energy design. Soldiers of the 162nd Engineers helped in the infrastructure upgrades of a different kind in February. Through the innovative readiness training program, the engineers were able to help clear and level the ground for Oregon's World War II Memorial. The memorial, situated on the northwest corner of the Capitol grounds, was finished and dedicated in June.
Today, however, we have the opportunity to say to all World War II veterans, present and those no longer with us, thank you.
The event drew hundreds of World War II veterans and their families to honor and remember the greatest generation. The Oregon Air Guard also improved their infrastructure this past year with the completion of shelter bays for the jets that keep the northwest skies safe. These new shelters will allow the jets to avoid the wear and tear of Oregon's weather, reducing corrosion and the need for repainting and de-icing, saving enough money to pay for themselves in 5 to 6 years. Oregon will be better prepared in the event of an earthquake or tsunami, thanks to the efforts of the Oregon Office of Emergency Management. In July, OEM and Governor John Kitzhaber rolled out the Cascadia Playbook, a comprehensive step-by-step plan outlining how various state and federal agencies will respond to a catastrophic event in Oregon. The playbook is a living document that can be updated and refined as lessons are learned from disaster situations that occur around the world. Once a year, all National Guard units must conduct their annual 2-week training requirement, where soldiers and airmen train together in order to gel as a unit. This year, engineers from the 162nd Engineer Company and gun crews from the 2 to the 218th Field Artillery Battalion trained at the Yakima Training Center in Washington, testing and honing their warfighting skills. The senior engineers tested various types of charges with the C4 explosives and shared their knowledge with the young troops. The results were explosive. Gun crews from the 2 to the 218th Field Artillery Battalion had little downtime during AT training this year due to a new approach in the rate of fire implemented during this AT period. The call to fire was nonstop, keeping the artillerymen on their toes. This operational tempo set new records for the battalion, and staying busy proved good for morale. Dusty grit, diesel exhaust, and the thunder of cannon blasts filled the air as soldiers with the 3rd Battalion, 116th Cavalry Regiment trained for 3 weeks at the Orchard Combat Training Center in Idaho. The battalion focused on increasing their proficiency with Abrams M1A2 system enhanced package tanks, Bradley fighting vehicles, and enough mortars to shake the dirt out from under the high desert tumbleweeds. 2014 was another challenging yet successful year for the Oregon National Guard. Soldiers and airmen deployed all over the world, responded to domestic emergencies, and trained for worst-case scenarios, all while staying involved in their communities. Once again, the Oregon Guard has proven that when we are needed, we are there.
Could just hit a couple of last second points here. One thing I'd like to highlight is we're an organization of about 9,000. Our federal budget and state budget is about $400 million. 93% of that comes from the federal government and 7% from the state. But we could not do anything without the 7% that we get from the state. When we look at the state investment of about $28 million, we bring over $300 million in payroll back into the state of Oregon, so almost a 10-for-1 return. So we're very proud of that fact that we utilize federal resources whenever and wherever possible. Something that was not in any of these slides, but I want you to hear from me personally, is my number one priority in everything, and is if you look across the bottom of those slides, character's the first one for a reason. We lead everything with the truth in this organization, and we are 100% transparent because we are a public entity. And, of course, with 9,000 people, you know, we face our challenges like everyone does. But we owe it to our state and our nation and our communities that when we find those, that we fix them, and we will. So that concludes my briefing. I'm open for any questions you may have.
Questions?
No, yeah. Thank you.
It was good.
Yeah, that was a great presentation. Thank you very much. Ms. Gilbert, what are we back for tomorrow? Well, I'll close my public hearing, first of all, and then we'll find out what's in store for tomorrow.
Military will continue presenting tomorrow, and it appears that we will go with Mr. Stuckey. And I'm thinking, yes, we'll talk more about the state program. So tomorrow and Thursday is still military.
Excellent. Thank you. Anything else for the good of the order? We are adjourned.